Menards' 11% rebate is here. From lighting to lumber, from doors to floors, the bigger the project, the bigger the rebate. From painting projects to that new kitchen makeover and designing that outdoor space of your dreams, save big on any project you're tackling. Hurry into Menards for an 11% rebate on everything. Mail-in rebate is a merchandise credit check, not a point-of-sale discount. Redeemable on future in-store purchases only. Not on future purchases on Menards.com. See store for details. Save big money at
Menards. This episode comes from my archives. For the most current episodes, please go to germwarfare.com. Cary Grace, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
What is your background?
I have a PhD in philosophy, and I've worked as a journalist for a long time. I actually worked in Rome, and that's where I met my husband many years ago. But now I'm mainly a stay-at-home mom, but I found that writing books actually worked really well with our family. Through the books, I've written 10. I am now a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and I spend a lot of time talking about books and now particularly women's issues, which I didn't really want to get into, but I have. And here we are talking about my latest book, The End of Woman.
Why didn't you want to get into women's issues?
You know, I think partially because initially I just thought a lot of the stuff, the work that was being done on women was incredibly boring. It was very academic, and it was really, what I was really looking for was ways that I could actually help women that I knew. And most of the women that I know are not going to read a really long, boring book that uses a lot of highly technical philosophical terms and whatnot. So anyway, that was really why I also think it's just a really hard area. You know, it's, women can be not nice sometimes, and it's really challenging to sort of parse out what has happened with women and how do we start bringing back really authentic femininity. And I just wasn't seeing anywhere on the landscape that people were doing that. And so I initially kind of rejected it, and then I just started getting into, I wrote a book about motherhood, actually, about how, you know, motherhood is actually meant to be hard because it, you know, irons out your narcissism and it increases your virtues. And so that's really how I got started. And it was thinking about, well, what are all these hard things that women are rejecting, that what are we missing out by rejecting them? And just kept going from there. So that was really what pulled me into it.
The End of Woman, How Smashing the Patriarchy Destroyed Us. Why should I read that?
I think anybody should read this book who sees what's happening with women today and just is scratching their head and can't figure out why. Women are miserable. Men are miserable. Children are miserable. We have, you know, it's just, there's no proof that feminism has made women happier. And I think that's, you know, my book really answers that question. How do we get to this point? How do we get to this place where it's now somehow acceptable to say that a man is a woman. And I think all of these things have been trending for about 200 years. And I think also it's, you know, this book has been really interesting because the fact that it hasn't, you know, obviously I am a woman, and there's not a lot of work being done on it by men because they get called sexist and they can't really make progress. In fact, it's been great to see the reactions of men to this book, because I think I'm very sympathetic to what men have endured because of feminism. And I've suddenly had all these men that have done all this research on feminism sending me data. And, you know, there's a lot out there. And I'm finding more things by women, of course, too. But it's just really amazing how taboo of a topic it has been. And I think that people's eyes are open significantly when you read this book, because suddenly you're like, you understand what has happened and why we're in this space where we don't know what a woman is. And, you know, everybody seems to be pretty miserable by what feminism has done.
I'm obviously being facetious. I have a digital copy of your book because I wasn't, there wasn't enough time for me to get the physical book and have you on my podcast in time. But yes, I agree. Everybody should read it. Take me through it just very briefly, assume that I don't know what's in it.
This book really starts with first wave feminism. And, you know, I think as a conservative, I just had been told over and over again that the first wave feminism was actually really good. And the women of the first wave are really great models for women. And so I thought, okay, I'll spend like two days researching this, find some nice quotes to talk about how wonderful the first wave is. And the more I got into it, you know, it took months because there was just so much data that I had never heard and nobody talks about in the first wave. And what I was really able to distill looking back at really the 1800s was to just see that there's this definition of feminism that has emerged very early on. It includes three things. One is the occult. And I think this is always hard for us to wrap our minds around because we think of the 1800s as very puritanical or Victorian. There's this effort to promote free love and get rid of monogamy and the nuclear family. That's the second thing. And then the third thing is this idea of egalitarianism, which has become this idea of smashing the patriarchy, how we want to get rid of the differences between men and women and kind of level the playing field. And all of those things, I think, you know, to different degrees, have their different appeals. But when you put them all together, it makes this incredibly powerful ideology. And that's what happened in the 1800s, kind of this myth of the independent woman. Or really, you know, I think feminism was asking the question, how do we make women more like men? And so if you see that kind of overriding question of how do we make women more like men, that's what you see in the 1800s. And then in the 1900s, it actually gets more interesting because it maps on, all these three things map on to communism. And communism pushes it even further with, you know, we saw in the Soviet Union this effort to destroy the nuclear family, promote atheism, and to really make women like men. I mean, abortion was available everywhere. In fact, they, you know, you couldn't own a stitch of property, but you could get an abortion. And I heard of one woman who actually said that she had had 80 abortions because they were just so common. Yeah, 80 abortions. So they actually ended up having a real problem with birth dearth, and they had to like hedge back on abortion back in under Stalin. In any event, this is all first wave still. And then finally you get to someone like Betty Friedan, who actually was, it was fascinating to research her because she is very much a communist and was able to hide it incredibly well. And yet you can see it in her book, The Feminine Mystique, which this, she's really the start of the second wave of feminism. And in it, she's trying to get women outside the home. She's calling the home a comfortable concentration camp. And she's really promoting this idea that our happiness is going to come when we're outside the home doing productive work. And she's taking all of that from Engels and Marx and just hiding it and putting it in very clever psychological jargon that I think women really, it really resonated with. And so that book sold 3 million copies within the first few years and still is a bestseller. So that really set off the second wave. And of course, then we now are in the third and fourth waves, which, you know, who can even figure out what those things are, because they're such a mess. But that's the arc of it, is really recognizing there was these seed ideas and then how they've just been manifest throughout the last 200 years.
What confuses me is the fact that there are waves. I mean, that immediately signals some sort of alarm bell for me. Why would there be a need for waves?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's actually a really good question, because I can look back at the first wave and see that there's not really a break. You know, I think the second wave is called that because of the fact that it really exploded on a cultural level. And there were reasons for that. I mean, this was all sort of plotted by someone like Wilhelm Reich and Herbert Marcuse, who were both of the Frankfurt School. They saw Marxism as a problem because it was only affecting the classes. And they shifted it and made it affect men and women. So they take these Marxist ideas and they basically say women are the oppressed, men are the oppressors, and naturally women are victims and men are the victimizers. So it's a really interesting slant that happens in the second wave. So there are distinct fact, you know, differences between these elements, but the distinctions between the first and the second waves, I think, have really been overstated. And certainly there were some women who said some lovely things about women in the movement in the first wave, but those are not the leaders. Those are not the Elizabeth Cady Stantons and the Susan B. Anthonys who are promoting this. In fact, they were much more involved in the three things I mentioned, the occult and you know, getting rid of Christianity and all of these kinds of elements that most people have no idea about.
I think what I was asking is more about the fact that it's either feminism or it isn't. You know, why would you have degrees of it? And that suggests to me that it has nothing to do with women.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really great point. Some of it, who am I to defend it? I'm obviously not a pro-feminist person, but I can see them trying to make these different distinctions and breaks. Now, are they a distinction without a difference? Maybe, but I think that there was definitely something that broke open in this second wave that they're trying to highlight really some intense intellectual differences in that era. Someone like Kate Millett would not have flourished under first wave, where she, this is a woman who's advocating for pedophilia and really thought abortion was just a rite of passage for women. You know, if men could be soldiers and kill innocents, then women needed to be just as tough and kill their own children. She wanted genderlessness and, all kinds of radical things that you hear smatterings of in that first wave, but the second wave just took it to another level. So I think it's just a matter of escalation, really. I think that's a good question.
Take me back to the roots of feminism. Was there actually a need for it?
So this is, I think, a really great question. I think that it's a hard thing to wrap your mind around because we're talking about the 1800s here when people shower like once a year. They bathe like once a year. They don't have antibiotics. They don't have the basic things that we can take for granted. And so it's easy to look back and say, oh, it was terrible for women. But it was also horrible for men. It was just life was really challenging on so many levels because of poverty. The Industrial Revolution changes a lot of things. And this is not to say that, women there weren't challenges. In fact, I opened my book with this harrowing story of this awful situation of an English woman who came to the United States and she's raped and she has a baby in a blizzard in an attic and the baby freezes to the floorboards and she's tried for manslaughter. Anyway, just horrible stories. I think that these are obviously should elicit sympathy from us and should elicit a sense of, how awful. But in terms of the way in which it has come about has just really undermined womanhood. So yes, there are certainly things that we can take for granted and that we're improved by it. Education's one of them. Voting is another one that gets referred to often. Our capacity to be involved in politics, all of those things. But it's come at an enormous cost. And I think that that's really the question that I'm asking in the book is, feminism, did it really need to destroy culture in order to promote women? And is it really promoting women? Is it really good for women if you're actually destroying, our understanding of what womanhood is? So certainly there were things that always could have been improved and, just basic poverty and the elevation of the middle class did alleviate a lot of that. I think that it's the price that was paid for it wasn't worth it. Excuse me.
Are you suggesting that the natural organic nature of progress would have elevated women and men without the need to politicize it in the form of feminism?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, these are the things that we're seeing already. There were women who were getting education was being opened up to men and women in different ways. You had a different opportunity. And this is what even something like the dishwasher, just think about how dramatically this changed women's lives. Washing clothes, like just on a practical level, women had a kind of freedom and free time that came from these technological changes. So I think those are really things that we can't overlook. And, I know in my life, I push a button and my clothes are washed and my sons change the laundry for me and my daughters and I usually fold it and, it gets taken care of, but we're not out there with the washboard trying to wash our clothes all day long. And so it's these little technological differences that I think have made huge differences in women's lives such that we had time. We also have wealth to be able to go to, take classes and educate ourselves in ways that people who were just scraping by trying to, subsist and keep themselves alive certainly didn't. So all that context, I think, is super important.
Mm. You mentioned occult. Explain a little bit, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so this was one of the fascinating elements that I found in my research. There was a book called Satanic Feminism. The subtitle is really gripping. It's something like how Lucifer freed 19th century women or something like that. Anyway, this book was written by a scholar in Sweden, and it was published by Oxford University Press. So this isn't some sort of like bogus, bizarre book. It's very well documented and very serious. And in it, I found really all these incredible connections between, and this was obviously corroborated by other elements and things that I read, but this is what got me really thinking and seeing the layers of the occult in the 18th century in particular. But it starts actually, curiously, the occult element starts with Percy Shelley. And this is a, you know, feels like a very random person because he's obviously not a feminist icon. But Percy Shelley is an English poet, romantic poet, who was the son-in-law of Mary Wollstonecraft. And Mary Wollstonecraft died before they met. She died delivering her daughter, Mary Godwin, later Shelley. And they obviously didn't meet, but he knew of her reputation because she was so esteemed as this woman, you know, promoting the women's movement. And he used a lot of her ideas. And then he also used a lot of his father-in-law's ideas, whom he did know, William Godwin, who was married to Mary Wollstonecraft. And Godwin was really the first anti-monogamist thinker that was taken seriously. He was very influential upon Marx, but he just thought that marriage was a kind of slavery. And so Percy Shelley is influenced by both of these ideas, but he's also fascinated by the devil and the demonic. And he got sent out of, I think, Oxford for writing something about atheism. And anyway, he was just kind of this bad boy. And, you know, it was just this disastrous life. There were so many women that committed suicide because of him, including his first wife. There were all these children that he fathered that died for various reasons, some natural, some of them sort of created by his own will. So in any event, he's the one that in his poetry put together all this work of his in-laws and created this woman, Sithna, who was this ideal woman who didn't have to work. And she didn't, her only real relationship, or she didn't have to be married, and she didn't have children. And obviously there were women who had the life like this, but he really idealized this independent woman, you know, myth. And made it very glamorous. And I think that was very compelling to the women. But one of the other things that he did was he rewrote Genesis and made Eve a heroine instead of, you know, the tragic figure that Genesis sees her as, this tempted woman. And in this, you know, Eve becomes this source of knowledge and her fallen nature. And so these ideas really were kind of the seedbed of the movement. And you see this in someone like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who's doing the exact same thing. She's really promoting this idea of how do we reinvent Eve based on some of Shelley's works mediated through other occult women. So that's one aspect of it. The other one is just the amount of seances that Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony were involved in. I mean, this was a time of the Second Great Awakening in the United States. And the occult was very rampant. And so her idea for the Seneca Falls Convention actually happened at one of these tables that they said would knock, the spirits would knock, and you could sort of get answers to your questions at the spirit table. And that table's actually in the Smithsonian today. So yeah, it's really remarkable when you start digging into it just to see how active the occult was in the movement. And of course we see it so, you know, it's a wash in the movement today. All these celebrities are involved in witchcraft and tarot and horoscopes and, you know, all these kinds of aspects that it just feels very natural. But it was obviously a piece in the early wave too.
So just for clarity, there's a difference between feminism and femininity.
Mm-hmm. So feminism is an ideology that is really promoting this idea of the independent woman, or making a woman like a man. So that's kind of the ideology that as it's moved forward for 250 years. Femininity is what you could say is the certain characteristics. They're not tied to and or limited just to women, but they're a reflection of some of the gifts that women have, and an expression of those gifts in a particular woman. So femininity is obviously much older and broader and bigger concept than feminism has ever been.
let me play devil's advocate, excuse the pun, but the suffragette movement, feminism, it's allowed women to have their own choices. You can do what you want. You don't have to be a receptionist. You can now be a pilot of an airplane. Why would that be a bad thing?
What is the problem with that? I mean, the real problem is that it's divorced us from who we actually are. And it's we no longer know what it means to be a woman, what it is that actually can make us happy and give us a fulfilling life. So objectively, those things are fine. But what they're not put in within the context of who a woman is, who she's meant to be, the gifts that she has, and even within a community, within a family setting. You know, we know reproduction is pretty important. And this is the big piece.
It's quite important.
It's a little important. But, you know, you're laughing at it, but this is what's fascinating is that feminism has led us to believe that it's not important, that it's just sort of like, I might or might not have children. You know, it's sort of become this like getting a driver's license. Like it doesn't feel like it has this critical weight to it that obviously was the case before, you know, out of default. But in any event, I think this is the real key is that because we're seeing that women are not happier, you know, and I think feminism would be more compelling if we could see that women was making women happier. Well, all it's really doing in so many respects is making women more isolated. It's creating this narrative that we're going to have this rich and full life. And then when women get to this place later on in their lives, they're wondering, this is not what I was promised. I don't have a husband. I don't have children. I have a career, but you know, you hit any kind of a career crisis or you retire, all of that community that you thought you were building over the years is gone. And, you know, it's incredible how many women I've met who their parents have died. They didn't have siblings. You know, they're sort of scratching their heads. Like, why did I buy into all of this? Because I don't have the kind of family or life that I wanted. And I think there's also a question of we're making these decisions, you know, from this feminist point of view, really in our 20s and 30s about marriage and family and children. And they're affecting our lives, you know, when we're least vulnerable in our lives, and they're affecting our lives when we're most vulnerable. And so there's not really this long sense of life and all of the aspects that make it rich and beautiful and compelling. So I think that's the bigger issue is that, sure, in short term, these things feel very satisfying and compelling. And it's great to feel like you are making your own money and doing, you know, using your gifts. But if in fact, it's actually only a very limited aspect of who you're meant to be, that's really where the problems come in, I think.
How did we arrive at the point where we are quite genuinely asking the question, what is a woman?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is the piece when you take out motherhood and you basically make what a woman does to be or what a woman is to be what a woman does. And this is a big philosophical question, you know, the difference between metaphysics and ontology. What does it mean to be something? You know, what's a human nature? That's the question that we've sort of swept under the carpet. And instead we've said, well, what do women do? And therefore that must be what a woman is. And this is obviously opens the door to men being women. Because if they can do the same things that women do, wear makeup and high heel, I mean, it's obviously a caricature generally. But if you take fertility out of it, then that's really where everything kind of goes off the rails. So, yeah.
The thing is, you say it's kind of like a caricature. I remember growing up watching Bugs Bunny cartoons. And in more than one cartoon, he would dress up as a female character. And it's very funny. Mm-hmm. And the reason why it's funny is because we all know that he wasn't actually wanting to be a woman.
Right.
We've now reached a point where if you see that on Cartoon Network, you're not sure.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, there's also a lot of other pieces. I think, you know, Nietzsche plays into it and Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre and this idea of authenticity, which has created this distinction interiorly where, again, it goes back to being where you can have the outward appearance of something, but internally you think you're someone or something else. I'm a woman trapped in a man's body and vice versa. That kind of idea obviously never existed beforehand, but because of this concept of being authentic to our inner self, that's really detached us so much from the inside and the outside being connected in a deep, deep way. Kind of that separation of soul and body has happened.
If I'm following, you're suggesting that feminism has shifted the age of marriage and having children, for example, from the natural age, let's say young 20s or mid 20s, now into mid 30s. You end up having fewer kids or not even getting a husband.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you have a career.
Yeah, it's really made women focused on their careers and thinking that that is really the goal of their life. And, you know, I remember growing up and just feeling kind of embarrassed that I wanted to get married, that I wanted to have children. Like, that was something I just didn't tell people. You know, it was something that I absolutely wanted, but it just felt kind of humiliating. And it felt much more in line with the culture. And I was much more encouraged to speak about what I was doing with my life. And it's a fascinating thing because as a woman, you can control those elements. You can control where you're going to go to college, you know, to a certain degree. You can control different career choices. It's very hard to control the man that you want to marry you, to ask him to marry you. You know, these elements. It's also, women have found out, you know, sadly, the hard, very difficult ways. It's also hard to control your fertility sometimes in various ways. I mean, these are things that are sort of, we don't have the kind of control on that we want. And this is, you know, in a lot of respects, what abortion is and why abortion is so rampant, because we've been told our careers are more important and our independence is more important. And that's why we have to have abortion in order to level the playing field so that we can be like men and we're not burdened by abortion. So yeah, all of these things have absolutely been the fruit of feminism. They were not part of really improving women's lives. They were just trying to, they're really risk aversion in a lot of respects. Women didn't have to be vulnerable. I mean, nothing makes you more vulnerable than actually having a baby. You can avoid all of these kinds of things that might hurt you. And that's, I think, so much of the appeal of it is just being able to control our lives in ways that you don't when you're getting married and having a family and feel like you're dependent on other people in your life.
The elephant in the room is gender roles.
Yeah. And that's been the amazing thing too, is just to see how much, you know, this language of toxic femininity. And I know men feel this intensely, just this sense of, I don't even know what I'm supposed to do when I'm in relationship with a woman anymore. Do I open doors? Do I make comments? How do I lead? You know, all of these things are really challenging. And I think they're also have really denigrated the gifts that men have and that they bring to the table as well. So I think that's a real, something else that has been absolutely sacrificed because we've made them something negative.
Mm. So what you're suggesting is that men and women have different roles to play and those differences should be celebrated rather than reduced to the same thing.
Exactly. And that's what feminism has done, is tried to get rid of genders altogether. And this is why you can see this. Percy Shelley talks about it and it's all the way through the whole movement. But there are certain things and gifts that we have and we need to use those well instead of pretending they don't exist or thinking that they're somehow bad.
I can't help but think that there's a strong correlation between what you're talking about and one's value system, even religious beliefs.
No, without a doubt. And I go into this in the second to the last chapter of the book because it's really remarkable to see that, you know, so much of it is driven, again, by the occult in the early waves, but also atheism and communism. I mean, these are all really grasping at trying to make man God, trying to get rid of God and put man in control and in charge of things. And so when you go down this road, and, you know, I focus on the work of J.D. Unwin. I don't know if you got to this part of the book or not, but he's a sociologist back in the 30s, I think, that he didn't have any kind of religious conviction, but he started studying cultures and he saw that cultures had this kind of growth period. And when they got to a certain point in the culture, he saw after studying 80 or 86 of them, that he knew they were going to start decaying and dying when they got to this one point. And that one point was really the end of monogamy and the end of premarital chastity. That was what started it. So it's really interesting because he said there will be three things that will follow it. One of them is the end of monogamy. The other one is The End of Faith, and then the third one is End of Reason. So all of these things, I think, are going together. And of course, we can see, you know, the destruction in those elements in the culture today.
You mentioned free love earlier. That was part of one of the waves of feminism. I think the 1960s are a great example of the sexual revolution. But that didn't actually liberate women, did it?
No, in fact, it hasn't. And I think that's, you know, I feature one of the stories of some of the women that were connected with Percy Shelley and Lord Byron. And, you know, it's just tragic what these women went through in terms of bearing their children and then just all the dysfunction because there's no real family structure. And that's just the incredibly sad piece of it, is to really see how much these women have suffered. And I think, you know, we see this now, but it's hidden much more carefully by certainly contraception and then abortion and all of those elements that make it easier to sort of hide the evidence of, you know, what free love brings about and without the commitment of marriage.
I agree with what you're saying. And I think it's almost like a no-brainer. And it's weird that we're having this conversation in the year 2024. But we are having it because of the way the system has created the vectors for this bizarre conversation that we are now having. We should, you know, it goes without saying that marriage is a good idea and that having a family is a good idea. Mm-hmm. And yet now we are finding ourselves defending it.
I think it's really remarkable, actually, how, because of the fact that we don't have reason, you know, we're so driven by emotions and that, I think that is really why we've gotten to this place in so many respects, where we can't sort of discern, like, of course it makes sense to have a child within marriage and create a foundation for the growth of the child. And we know that all the studies show that women, that children are happier, couples are happier, you know, all these kinds of details. And yet, because we've been fed the lies of feminism for so long, we just can't really see, you know, the forest through the trees anymore. And this is where all the confusion is coming from, because it's just this constant message in the culture that these are good things that we should have, you know, at our disposal for at any time we want.
It's interesting you point out atheists. I have, in my anecdotal experience, found that the majority of women who are not feminists tend to be Christian. Mm-hmm. Have you found the same?
Yeah. I have, although it's been really interesting. I'm finding more and more women who are open to it because they're miserable, or they see the misery around them. There's sort of this inchoate sense that what they're doing isn't working. And, you know, I think that's part of it. But I think also, yeah, Christianity certainly opens up your eyes to a lot of these things, because feminism is fundamentally anti-Christian in so many respects. I mean, all these three elements, free love, you know, smashing the patriarchy and the occult, are absolutely all against the Christian message.
Let's just talk about smashing the patriarchy for a moment. The idea of the patriarchy, quote unquote, is that men are just horrible, oppressive, abusive. You know, we drag women by their hair through the cave.
Right, right. With unbridled sexual needs that they can't control and all of that. Yeah, that's really the vision. And, that, you know, I learned recently, actually, this is not in the book, but I learned recently that in the 1800s, there was this belief that male sexuality was bad and impure, but somehow women's sexuality was not, that it really was good. And so this is this sort of clash and this, you know, cognitive dissonance. How is it that we can have women who are good and men who are bad doing the same thing and somehow make it think that it's going to actually work out well? So yeah, this is really the vision that so many had, is that, and still have, is that, you know, men are the enemy and we have to really control them and tamp them down and, you know, teach them how to behave, really.
I think it's very interesting because as a male, I see this around me, even here on the African continent, how men are now seen as toxic simply for being men. I go hunting and that is seen as a toxic behavior. I'm shooting things, you know, why must you kill?
Right.
And the irony is that that's how it's always been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because people had to survive. And now we're so removed from our food sources. We're so removed from thinking about how people have to survive. I think a lot of this is really fed into because of our own wealth as well. You know, if you get a natural disaster, suddenly people very quickly go back into gender roles. They fall very easily back into, you know, this is what women do and what men do. So I think a lot of it is just because we don't think these things are necessary anymore for our survival, that they've sort of created this sense of, you know, this false sense of what reality is.
So basically feminism, which was meant to, shall we say, lift up women, liberate women, free women, has in many ways enslaved women and men.
Yeah, no, for sure. Because people can never really flourish when they're in their own, when they're not doing what they're meant to do. And so we've created these really artificial understandings of what it is that men and women do. And so this is, yeah, they're never going to flourish in it.
How do we push back, though? It seems like it's a train coming towards us.
Yeah, I mean, this is why I wrote the book, I think, by and large, because we have to start pushing back. We have to start recognizing what the real problem is and identifying it and then saying, no, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to create my own life and live within who I am made to be biologically and on a spiritual level and go from there.
If you're not a feminist, what are you?
Well, I've been called an anti-feminist. But I think women in general, you're just a woman. I think that feminism is an ideology. You know, it sort of asks the question, like, if you're not a Marxist, what are you? If you're a worker and you're not a Marxist,
you're just
what
a
are
normal
you?
Person.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Would you say that feminism exists in stark contradiction to femininity?
Yeah, because feminism is trying to make women more like men, and femininity is trying to embrace who women are.
But at the same time, feminism is also trying to emasculate men.
Yes, because it's trying to get rid of gender altogether. So yeah, it's both, and for sure.
Where do you see all of this 50 years from now?
I think that unless we sort of figure out the real problem that we're dealing with, it's just going to get worse. And real decay happens. I think there is, gratefully, a lot of people that are waking up to what's happening and are starting to see it through better eyes. But yeah, I think that it's got to be one or the other, like total train wreck, or we like figure it out and start moving forward and building again, starting to create a real society.
Yeah, what's interesting to me is, I think that feminism is certainly a vector towards the cultural implosion in the West that that we're witnessing. Mm-hmm. And it's so strange to be saying this out loud, but in many ways, what we're seeing in the Middle East, the preservation of some of these traditions seems to be a good thing. There is a rejection of feminism across much of the Middle East in the more conservative regions. That's a good thing, isn't it?
Well, it is, but you have to ask the question, you know, what's motivating it, and is it balanced and healthy? I think it could also be seen as sort of a pendulum swing of the other direction. And I think that's really the hard part about feminism, is that it makes people have to feel like they have to react. And a lot of times I see this among men, is rather than seeing women through this lens of compassion, they really feel like this is awful. These women are terrible. We need to like belittle them. And so I think that that creates a lot of further division and divide. So it's really a question of how do we come back to something that's actually healthy and manageable instead of just these extremes, really.
And how do we?
Well, I mean, obviously I'm a practicing Catholic. I think that there's so many real keys in the faith. John Paul II wrote this incredible work called The Theology of the Body. And in it, he actually compares the family to the Trinity, where you have the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Instead, it's mapped onto the Father, the wife, and then through their love, there's the creation of the Holy Spirit. So I think that it's those kinds of concepts and those kinds of honoring of gifts and seeing them really within a larger context, and also seeing how that unit is the fundamental building block of the whole culture, those are really vital pieces to rebuilding. So I think the elements are there. It's just a matter of kind of being open to them and seeing that, you know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel.
I think that's really, really profound, because it's weird. When I met my wife, she had never really heard of feminism. She couldn't understand.
Where's she from?
She just grew up a good farm girl, conservative girl. And she just said, this is just the way things are. And when she started seeing all of the stuff that I see, you know, in my work, she couldn't believe it. She said, why are people doing all of this?
Buying this. Yeah.
Why can't they just be?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's it. Is we, you know, if you look at the West and our elite media, politics, book publishing, academia, it's entirely flush with these concepts. And that's why, because we don't really know an alternative. And I think that's what kind of the hardest part about what I'm doing is trying to help people get out of this sort of binary thinking that either you're a feminist or you're a doormat and an idiot. And that's what the leftists have done, is created this false binary. And so I'm always trying to figure out, you know, how do we start re-articulating this so that people actually have mental hooks of what it looks like to be just a normal woman. And so I've created several books called Theology of Home that really go into this idea of how do we start making women, you know, who are not feminists attractive again. And I think women who aren't feminists are more attractive. I mean, I think there's actually been studies done on it that it's objectively the case. You don't have to look far, but we are not at all doing a good job of making this case for people, of helping them see that, that distinction, because it's such a lock in the culture on leftist ideas. So in any event, that's really, I think, the big work for us, is to sort of start getting much more involved in culture and movies and TV shows and books, and really start showing that, like, what the alternative looks like instead of just
and own it.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Exactly.
At the end of the day, nobody actually likes a fat, tattooed, screaming lesbian nagging. with purple hair, you know?
Yeah. And that's what's so incredible is, you know, to really see the amount of rage and anger that are involved in the movement. You know, when you start paying attention to that, you just realize that there cannot be anything good coming from this, when that is the fundamental position in which women are engaging with those around them, you know, where people are afraid of them. And that's really how feminism has been so effective, is by fear and control. It's really about power. And I think that's why so many women are drawn to it, because they don't understand charity, love, forgiveness, you know, all these kinds of elements that are so key for really any kind of relationship, working relationship, or in the workplace, or with family. And they just become tyrants and very tyrannical, because their emotions and there's so much disorder and dysfunction in what it is that they're doing.
Okay, but then what would you like to see? Should women work?
Sure. I'm working. I'm a working woman. I don't think the problem is working. The problem is that we don't fundamentally see ourselves as mothers. And I don't mean that just biologically. I mean that spiritually and psychologically, mentoring others. You know, we have this great history of religious women throughout the history of Christianity, and even before that, who have spiritually led others to, you know, better places. So I think that is what I would love to see, is rather than trying to get women to keep thinking of themselves as, how do I compete with men? Why don't we start getting back to this fundamental idea that a mother is someone who shelters people and helps them become the person that they're meant to be? Why don't we go back to that, and that notion of helping us live this out in anywhere that we work or live? And I think that's really key, because it changes everything about you're no longer on a defensive stance. You're on a much more helping, serving stance in that role. And so I think that's the vital piece, is just shifting that one small thing in the way that women think.
I love what you just said now, the implication being men and women shouldn't compete.
Yeah. And that's what feminism has done, absolutely, is this focus on constant competition and creating this division and divide that keeps getting wider and wider and wider. But why? I mean, why do we have to be in that place? Why can we not come together in a place where I can recognize your gifts and you can recognize mine and we're building instead of destroying each other?
Let me throw a spanner in the works and suggest that you're just being an old fuddy-duddy. You're not going with the times. You know, you're trying to hold on to yesteryear.
Yeah. No, I love this because, you know, it's one of those funny things. Like I lived all of this and growing up and, I don't think we have to go back to be able to move forward. I think what we need to do is look at things with fresh eyes. And, you know, I think there's obviously were problems in the 1950s. And I'm not suggesting that we go back there for various reasons. But I think that there's a way to move forward with some of the benefits that we have without embracing all of this awfulness that has come with it, for sure.
I disagree with you. I would like to come home with my wife standing, waiting for me when the door opens with a plate of food.
In any event, I think this is a hard thing. I think there's really, there's so many amazing aspects to this. I mean, what you just said is, first of all, there's certainly the different dynamics.
I was just joking.
Well, come on. There's probably a little bit there that it wouldn't be, yes. You wouldn't complain about. But there's something we said I don't welcome my husband home with a plate of food. In fact, he's actually, since I wrote this book, he's taken over most of our cooking for dinner and I haven't quite taken it back yet. But there's different dynamics that, you know, a couple has to engage with. And if he comes home and the house is a mess and the children are a disaster and I'm angry, like that's not something to come home to. I mean, that's really challenging. And I have to be aware of that. And there have been days that he has come home and it's been like that. I'm not saying that's not the case, but I think just being mindful of how we treat one another and receive each other and care for each other is obviously really important. And, and husbands too, don't get to think that their real work is outside the home. It's, you know, you get home and you're raising your family is your most vital and important work. And if you could just come home and sit down and turn on the TV with the expectation that the martini is going to show up in your hand, you know, then there's going to be problems. And I think this is really where the rifts begin, is in this idea of being focused on self instead of being focused on a goal together and what it is that you're trying to build together as husband and wife.
But there is actually a dichotomy that cannot be ignored. If there are kids, they have to be parents. And if there are parents, at least one of them has to work. You can't both work and leave the kids at home with some strange nanny.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's been one of the myths. Actually, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Erica Commissar. She's a Jewish psychoanalyst in New York who's done all this work on children and infants and what it is that leads to healthiest, you know, mental states in children and adults, of course, because of it. And it is this idea of just recognizing how important childcare is by the mother in particular. But, you know, we don't all have the advantage of being able to stay home. And, you know, some of it is cultural. Some of it is keeping up with the Joneses. Some of it is just the reality. You also have kids. You know, we have 5 children, and that means we have tuition to pay for our education for all of our children for private schools because we're not going to send them to public schools. And so, you know, that alone is a kind of demand on a family that, you know, certainly didn't exist in the 1950s because you had all of these religious schools that were available at very low costs or no cost. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I think there's a lot of dynamics that go into it. But I think people are beginning to also pay attention to that children really do need a parent home or someone close to them, especially in those first 3 years, that is going to help them, you know, become a healthy adult, because those years are so critical for formation.
Okay. Let's come in for a landing. How can I get your book?
The book can be found obviously at places like Amazon, or it's in both Audible and Kindle forms. So if people don't want to wait for the version to get there, paperback version, or actually it's a hardback right now. Paperback's coming out in the summer. But yeah, that's probably the best place for people in your neck of the woods.
And just a reminder, the name of the book is The End of Women, How Smashing the Patriarchy Destroyed Us.
That's it.
Have you got a website?
The best place people can find my work is at theologyofhome.com, which is the website I alluded to. It's also a series of books that my colleague Noelle Mehring and I have published, basically trying to show how women can be beautiful again and how femininity can be a beautifully lived reality instead of some sort of awful scourge.
Kerry Griss, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportgerm.com.